The Veterans Report is sponsored by James Cannon.
Welcome to the Veterans Report, the region's only show dedicated to those who have served our country. We have the latest news and information on resources available to veterans, including health care, education, employment tips, local volunteer organizations, and more. To those who have served, those who are serving, and to those who will, we salute you. And now, the host of the Veterans Report, Jim Cannon.
Hi there, and welcome back to the Veterans Report. We appreciate you joining us today. So we are once again, we're going to sort of throw you a change up here, and we are going to introduce our guest today at the top of the hour, and then at the second half, we will cover the usual news and current events. We have with us today, and I'm really excited about this, we have with us Republican gubernatorial candidate Paul Mango. Paul, how are you?
Very good, Jim. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. So, obviously, being a veteran-centric show here, you are a veteran, and not just a vet, but you also you went full boat. You are an academy grad, and you also served with distinction with the 82nd Airborne. Do you want to walk a little bit through your military time and your background?
Sure, absolutely. Well, let me start with the background. Our family came to Pennsylvania from Italy about 100 years ago when my granddad left and arrived in Philadelphia and then worked up on the railroad in Susquehanna County for a couple decades. My dad, his son, was a National Guardsman when I was growing up and was assigned for a while to a Special Forces unit. And believe it or not, when I was 7 years old, he went to airborne school. That was 1966. And when he came back with his green beret and shiny jump boots and had lost about 20 pounds, had a short haircut, I said, geez, I think I want to be that guy, right? And I didn't really recognize him at first, but I knew it was something special. So, when I was 18, I only applied to one college, and that was West Point. And I was very fortunate to get in, very, very fortunate to get in. For those of you who don't think the government ever gives you a bonus, I got a bonus at West Point. It was called my wife. I met her there. She was, she's the class of 1982. I'm the class of 1981. Had a wonderful time, very transformational experience, as you can imagine, going to West Point. Had the honor of receiving my diploma from President Ronald Reagan in May 1981, shortly after he was shot. And I think this was his second or third public appearance, but that was a very inspirational day for me. And just a word about my wife and her family. Her brother was at the Naval Academy when she and I were at West Point. So a little bit of a rivalry within the family. And she comes from a long line of veterans as well. And so we just had a lot of military history in our family lineages. And we finished our time at West Point and went off to the 82nd Airborne Division down at Fort Bragg. I was commissioned as a field artillery officer, so I was in the second of the 3-2-1st field artillery. Wonderful assignment. As you know, at least at the time, the mission of the 82nd Airborne Division was be anywhere in the world in 48 hours. So that meant, and prepared to fight, of course, that meant we had to train in all environments, the snow, the mountains, the desert, the jungle, the swamps. Fantastic training for a young officer. And then our second assignment was in Germany, 8th Infantry Division in Germany in the mid-80s. So a lot going on. If you remember Reagan putting Persian missiles in Europe in the protests, and I remember him sending some F-111Bs down to take care of Gaddafi, or at least try to. There was a lot of things going on during that time, geopolitically, as you know. And so that was... That was our second assignment. And then I left Germany, went to Harvard Business School in Boston. Great time there. And then moved to Pittsburgh in 1988. So we've been here in the Commonwealth about 30 years. And my wife and I have 5 daughters, one of whom also attended West Point. She graduated in 2014. So we're big Army fans with 3 West Point graduates in the family. I'm outnumbered by the women though, Jim. It's 2 women and 1 guy.
You'll never win that fight.
But she's an air defense artillery officer. She was hopeless and still is. She was in Korea for 16 months, got back, and now she's at Fort Sill going through her advance course. And, you know, I had a career in healthcare for the last 25 years, working with a great firm called McKinsey & Company, and worked all over the world in 35 different countries. So just a spectacular, you know, a set of opportunities and blessings and privileges in my life, from attending West Point to leading soldiers to going to Harvard Business School, having a great career, a great family, a great wife for almost 36 years, and it's just been spectacular. So that's a little bit about my background and my military, some of my military activities.
All right, well, that's it. That's the whole interview. No, I'm just so I think you're being a little humble too. You also, for those who don't know, you went through Ranger School. Which is an arduous task, and really you have bragging rights for that, because not a lot of people have that experience, Paul.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that. When I was in 1979, between my sophomore and junior years at West Point, highly competitive, they chose 40 cadets out of 1,000 to go down to Fort Benning, starting in Fort Benning anyway, to attend Ranger School. And it was boy, we had to go through land navigation certification before, you know, and physical fitness tests, and, you know, how to disassemble and assemble an M60 machine gun in 90 seconds. We had to go through the whole ritual of preparatory activities, and they chose 40 of us, very privileged, again, to be among those 40, and spent the summer of 1979, 9 weeks down there at Fort Benning and Dahlonega, and then to the swamps of Florida. So I tell people, when you hear someone saying they were up to their butts or necks in alligators, it was actually true a couple times when we were at Ranger School.
well, and inherent to Ranger School, right, are the leadership principles that are instilled in everyone, right? I think that's the important takeaway.
Yeah, you don't graduate from the U.S. Army Ranger School unless you have an unusual ability to motivate folks and as a leader. And the reason why is it's 9 weeks with very little sleep and one meal a day. And you are trying to, you know, lead folks under very difficult conditions. And a lot of teamwork was involved as well, because you always, we talk about it today, 40 years later, my Ranger buddies. That's, we refer to each other. It's 503, that's 503-79. Everyone remembers who goes through Ranger School what that number is and who their Ranger buddies were. And they're some of my closest friends in my life. But wonderful experience, wonderful leadership experience, and, you know, self-confidence type of thing, if you can get through that.
So you went on, as you already mentioned, to Harvard Business School. And then when you left school, is that when you went to work for McKinsey & Company?
Yes, absolutely. Straight to Pittsburgh.
So were they healthcare right off the bat? Have they always been healthcare?
No, actually, it's very interesting. The model at the time was you'd go to a given geographic location and you would serve clients of all sectors, all economic sectors in that geography. So Pittsburgh at the time was one of the leading cities in the country in terms of Fortune 500 headquarters. This was still in the 80s. And so there were a lot of, you know, from U.S. Steel to Westinghouse to obviously PPG, Alcoa, Heinz. They were all here, and this was an area where we thought we could serve clients effectively. And then what happened in the mid-90s was a client started to tell us, hey, we love you guys, and you're good problem solvers and the whole thing, but we hate spending the first 4 weeks of any engagement teaching you about our industry. So can you send us some people who know something about the industry we're in? So we all had to pivot and get into a specialty area. And mine was healthcare, and I think this is relevant for your listeners. My very first client in healthcare was a guy named Rick Scott. Rick Scott is the governor of Florida, just announced his run for Senate down there.
Yep.
But Rick was the CEO of HCA, which was the largest hospital company in the world and still is, headquartered in Nashville. But I talked to Governor Scott a couple months ago, and he told me the following. His dad was in the 82nd Airborne Division in World War II.
Oh, wow.
And he said there were 5 combat airborne operations that the 82nd participated in World War II, and his dad participated in every one of them.
Oh.
I think that's a pretty good story, isn't it, Jim?
Jeez, you don't hear that ever.
No, I said, man. Rick, I said, I think your dad's an N of one. I'm not sure there's anyone else in the world that did that, if you think about it, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think there is.
Just to survive that.
Wow.
That was some tough duty.
That's amazing.
But But anyway, so yes, so I became a specialist in healthcare. But Jim, what we really did, everyone calls me a healthcare expert. There's really three things I did at McKinsey. Yes, I served for 25 years clients in healthcare. So I did learn a lot about healthcare. But we built a healthcare business. We didn't have one. I worked with a team. I was chosen as the leader of that team of colleagues. And we wound up building what's today a $600 million healthcare business. It's huge. We do business, as I said, in about 35 countries. But what we really did was, in serving our clients, it was multi-billion dollar organizations that had trouble changing themselves. They knew they had to change. They knew they had to adapt, evolve. And when you have 40, 50, or 60,000 employees and you have a history of success, boy, is it difficult to get people to change, right? Even if they know they have to do it. So we were brought in as agents of change and to lead transformational change programs. So I think, you know, I know you're going to ask me about what qualifies me for governor, but I have to tell you that I think that's required in Harrisburg today. Pretty dramatic change in the role that it plays in our lives. But anyway, wonderful career, wonderful career.
No, and I appreciate that. I do. and as far as being a healthcare quote unquote expert, you probably, I mean, I'm sure depending on who's asking the questions, they can define the word expert however they want. So, but you certainly have a lot of experience. We'll just leave that there. So let's start big picture. Now you're not a political guy. You're not up until a year ago, but you've not been a political person. You haven't held public office. You haven't run for office.
No.
And you decide, right? You're stepping back and you decide, hey, I'm going to dip my foot into the political pool. So I'm going to run for governor, which is a really big first step for anybody.
Yeah.
Why are you running for governor? And B, you know, there are specific qualifications for anybody running for that office. And in Pennsylvania, all they include are A, citizen of the United States, being at least 30 years old, and being a resident of PA for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Apart and aside from that, there's nothing else to find. So again, A, why choose governor? And B, what do you think, in your opinion or your mind, what qualifies you to serve as the governor of Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so let me go through that. I was actually asked twice to go to the federal government, once to Health and Human Services, given my healthcare background, and once to the Veterans Administration, given my healthcare and veteran background. And I went to D.C. both times, and I was offered the role both times, to be, in one case, assistant secretary, one case, deputy secretary. But I tested to see whether people were really prepared for change. An impact. And as I just described to you, over the years, I learned in advance to ask and pose a lot of questions to chief executives about, you know, they'd say, we want to change, Paul. We want to be modern. We want to be nimble. We want to be quick. And then I started asking questions. Are you willing to do A, B, and C? Well, not sure. And then I'd say, well, don't waste your time. I'm sorry, your money and our time, because we're not going to get anything done. So I'd go down and I asked in both cases, questions at the Veterans Administration. You said this is one of the president's top three priorities. Will he give me, as the turnaround guy, 30 minutes a month? That's a fraction of a percent of his time. That's all I want is 30 minutes a month. Well, I can't guarantee you that. Will he confront the public sector unions that in many ways are restricting change? Well, I'm not sure about that. Will he, if a VA hospital is failing for a decade and we can't fix it, will he be willing to shut it down? Well, I can't guarantee you that. So we kept on going through these questions, and at the end, they said to me, well, if we could guarantee all that, we wouldn't need you as a turnaround guy. And I said, well, if you can't, then we're not going to get anything done. So I'd been asked, you know, I'd been down in that sphere a couple of times, and then I'm a big supporter of Republican Senate candidates, mainly the veterans, Tom Cotton, close friend of mine, Joni Ernst, Todd Young, who's the new senator from Indiana, Naval Academy graduate. It pained me a little bit to send the money, but I did it anyway. No, I love the Naval Academy guys. But the point is, people started asking me. I was on Pat Toomey's finance committee in Western Pennsylvania twice. They asked me, will you run against Bob Casey? And I had the same conversation with these senators. I said, guys, tell me what you got done the first 6 years as a freshman senator in D.C. They had trouble answering. So then they said, well, why don't you think about running for governor? And I said, well, that sounds like an impactful job, but let me talk to six or seven governors. So I called my friend Rick Scott, Jeb Bush was a board member of one of my clients. Called him, talked to him. Bobby Jindal, Louisiana, former McKinsey guy. Doug Burgum up in North Dakota, governor, former McKinsey guy. Charlie Baker, Massachusetts, served with him in healthcare, or at least on panels at conferences and stuff. I knew him. Tom Corbett, Tom Ridge, I called them all. They said, Paul, this is the best job you'll ever have. You can have fantastic impact. And for the guys who are outside the state, they said, we'll trade you Pennsylvania for what we have. That's how much optimism they had for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So I said, I'm going to take a close look at this and talk to my wife and family. And we decided 16 months ago that a guy who has had as many privileges, as many blessings from God and country that I've had, it would be unpatriotic, Jim, not to try to help the good people of Pennsylvania, because we are hurting right now. And I think the principal cause of that hurt is lack of leadership. So that's how I got to the decision. And then you asked me, okay, well, what qualified me, right? What qualifies me for this job? And I've said that this is a true statement. There are literally over 1,000 years of political experience in Harrisburg today. If you take the legislature, 253 folks, over 1,000 years of political experience. In my mind, there aren't 2 days of executive leadership experience there. I think the principal factor that is holding us back is lack of leadership. And you say, well, we have a governor. Yeah, but he's not leading. Well, Paul, what's leadership then? Well, I'll tell you what, Jim, in the 30 years I worked in business and chief executive asked us to help them change, the first question we would ask them is, where do you want to wind up 5 years from now? 10 years from now, what's your vision for this company in the competitive array in the global economy? If they couldn't answer that question, we couldn't lead the change because we didn't know where we wanted to wind up. The governor has not done that. Every successful chief executive with whom I've worked has done that. They always have a compelling, positive vision because that motivates people to get the job done. And it's not just where we want to wind up, it's how are we going to get there and how are we going to help people through the transition? If you answer those three questions, change, dramatic change can happen quite quickly. But leadership, in my mind, is also what I say, Jim, it's about being out in front, not on top. I think you understand that metaphor, right? It's about being out in front, not on top. That means anticipating change and preparing your state or your organization in advance to seize the opportunities that may be coming or to protect them from harm and threats. And I don't see either of those two happening. Again, we lack leadership in Pennsylvania. We've been on top of a global revolution in energy production for a decade, since 2007. We're just now putting pipelines in the ground, right? We're almost a decade behind on that. The drug overdose epidemic, I know you want to talk about that maybe a little bit later. We're losing 100 a week, 100 Pennsylvanians a week to that are dying. Who is out in front leading that? I just don't see the leadership commensurate with that level of destruction. So you ask me what I think my qualifications are. More than anything else, it is understanding and delivering many times in my life the type of leadership that led to positive change.
Well, it almost sounds like, to a certain degree, and then we'll get off of this, to a certain degree, you look at this both from a, I mean, you're certainly melding some of your leadership principles from when you were a younger person, but a lot of this seems to be through a business lens.
Well, like I said, for almost 30 years, I worked with some of the most well-respected chief executives in the world, side by side with them, designing change programs, leading change, co-leading change programs, executing change programs. I know what works and what doesn't work. And people say, Paul, government's different. Well, maybe it is. But I got to tell you, the politics in corporate America, talk about politics, wait till you get to the corner office of a Fortune 100 company. Oh my goodness gracious, right? If you think it's vicious in Harrisburg, you've seen nothing, right? So bringing parties together, you say, how do you bring warring parties together? Well, first thing you do is listen to them, understand their points of view, have respect for diversity of opinion, okay? Ask them what their perspective is. And I'll just give you, again, I don't want to make this political, but we have about 20 county commissioners endorsing us, and I've asked more than 20, probably 30 or 40 county commissioners. When has our governor picked up the phone and called you and asked you, what are the priorities of the people in your county? Every one of them said the same thing. Never. Okay. So listening, I think, is very important. And then how do we get change when people had disagreements after that. I always tell folks, nothing succeeds like success. And what does that mean? That means, let's try it. Okay, let's take education, Jim, just for a second. We have 500 school districts. Why don't we take five of them and do something different? Why don't we say to the superintendent and the teachers who are dying, they're absolutely dying to offer us an alternative to the mandates and the restrictions that they have in our public school system. Say, guys, I only have two standards. Is the graduate prepared for meaningful work in a globally competitive economy, and is the graduate prepared to be a good citizen? I don't care how you get there. Tell us, give your best ideas. Let's develop a curriculum and an approach to teaching kids that gets them all there. I guarantee you that would create so much energy, right, in the five school districts. And listen, once something works, it's impossible to stop it, right? Nothing succeeds like success. And if it doesn't work, then let's try it again. Let's try something different, right? So these are techniques I've used for three decades, and they've been very successful in bringing change and bringing people together on a collaborative basis, because, you know, the facts on some of this stuff are hard to refute, and you need to show people what good looks like sometimes to get them to change.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's in short supply all too often. So yeah. You're talking under a bigger umbrella. You're talking statewide. Specific yep. to vets, let me walk down the veteran mm-hmm. path here. So Pennsylvania, and as you know, Pennsylvania has the fourth largest veteran population in the yep. country. And I happen to believe that statistic is often overlooked, not necessarily intentionally, but I think it's overlooked a lot. And I think that's kind of a big deal to point out, not to minimize what other states are doing and their populations, but we have the fourth largest in the country. And just last weekend, I spoke with the Deputy Adjutant General of the PA DMVA, which is the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Eric Weller, retired General Eric Weller. And the general was kind enough to walk me through all of the stuff that his department's doing. And I got to say, I was surprised. I didn't realize they were that busy. And that's problematic, because if they are doing that much, they're certainly not telling people. There seems to be a lot going on. But in your opinion, do you think Pennsylvania does enough for veterans in terms of all kinds of things, transitioning from service to civilian, job training, mental health services, general support? And if they aren't, what would you do to sort of, bolster that?
Yeah, I don't think we're doing enough, but I do give Pennsylvania credit for doing a lot. I'm not sure we're doing enough, and I'll come back to that. But let me just add to your 900,000. We have the third largest National Guard in the country, almost 20,000 soldiers and airmen. We have 100,000 plus active duty service members whose residence is Pennsylvania. And then, of course, we have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of more family members, parents, uncles, cousins, daughters, sons, right? So when you add this up, there are about 2 million plus in the Pennsylvania population that care deeply about our veterans or have people on active duty, you know, family members. So it's a big group of our 12 million citizens. But here's what we think is important, and that is, you mentioned it, the transition period. So we talked to hundreds of veterans, mainly post 9/11 veterans returning from combat zones, because that's a big part of what's happening now. You know, our National Guard has had about 60,000 deployments since 9/11, 20,000 members of that National Guard. So that means on average, and it's not the same people because there's been turnover, but on average, Pennsylvania National Guardsmen and women have deployed three times since 9/11. That's a lot, right? That's a lot of strain on their families. But the point is, that first 90 to 180 days after they leave the service or certainly leave a combat zone, that is a difficult transition. And what they're telling us is, Jim, these guys are in a combat zone. It's about duty. It's about mission. It's about never leaving a man behind. It's about having your buddies back. It's a set of shared values that are very intense. And they come back into the civilian world, and it's like, you know, it's a little bit disillusioning, because they don't feel the same sense of teamwork and camaraderie. And they often get themselves into trouble that first 90 to 180 days. So what we want to do is assign mentors, other veterans, and other veterans are very eager to do this, assign mentors to these vets as they're coming out of the service, coming out of combat zones, and help them through that transition, kind of from a counseling and encouragement and coaching standpoint. We think that's vital. That's one. Two, let's waive the licensing requirements for vets who have real skills, helicopter mechanics, truck drivers, nurses, right? They're bringing back extraordinary skills, in some cases, much more than you could ever get in an apprenticeship program in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, yet we're requiring many of them to relicense. It's expensive. It takes a lot of time. They're out of the workforce. They don't have a network of friends and that type of thing. Again, they get isolated, and that's when they start to get themselves into trouble. Third, there are over 1,000 veteran services organizations in Pennsylvania. These are organizations that want to help our veterans. They have trouble finding them, and the vets themselves have trouble finding the VSO that is most relevant to them. So I'll give you an example. In Pittsburgh, I was just at an event today. We're very close to an organization called It's About the Warrior. And they had a big hockey game up at the Lemieux Center today versus the state police. It was great. But the point is, they focus on post-9/11 veterans who need help with the transition period. Some of have lost their limbs. Some can't make a mortgage payment because they lost track of it while they were gone. They help them. Veterans Leadership Program, we've been active in that. That's for homeless, mainly for homeless Vietnam vets. That's what they focus on. My point is, each of these VSOs has a special kind of niche mission, but the vets don't know how to get a hold of them. They don't know what their missions are. So what we want to do is create an electronic marketplace. You can go to a website as a vet and say, I need help with my child's education. Boom. 10 Pennsylvania VSOs pop up. That's their mission. They're looking for you anyway. You contact them. So we think without creating a big bureaucracy, without spending a lot of taxpayers' dollars, we can address the critical transition period issues, get veterans help as they come back in. That's the thrust of what we're doing. I'd like to talk in a minute about the VA health, if you'd like, but those are the principal things we're doing.
And that sounds like a great plan. I think there needs to be a bigger push toward electronic records. And as you know, and we can get into the VA here, as you know, with the Electronic Health Record Initiative between the Defense Health Agency and,
yes.
You know, the VA, they're definitely trying to streamline. And I, God bless them, because that is a monstrous and monumental task, given the sheer number of records. But that's the direction everything's headed. So now, speaking of the VA, and I think I had teed this up with you, and this has nothing to do with Pennsylvania. Well, I guess secondarily it might, but this is about the VA, the federal VA. What is your? I mean, have you been watching this ongoing saga with, you know, with Shulkin, and then they have Ronny Jackson in there now, and you know, the VSOs. Some of them are very resistant to any kind of change, and some are tenuous in terms of, you know, the private healthcare blending with the existing VA hierarchy, I guess. What's your take on? And again, this is not a political thing. This is just your take on it. You worked in this sector for 25 years. What do you think?
Well, I think the VA health system has a mission impossible, and that is to provide all health care to all veterans that are enrolled in all geographies. It's a very difficult mission. And here's what I believe the VA should be. It should be about excellence in the areas that it has unique insights and capabilities to serve veterans. So what would that be? Traumatic brain injury, traumatic amputation, Agent Orange, PTSD combat related, right? There are things that only the Veterans Administration, given the data it has, access to veterans, and mission-wise, only it can do. I'd like to see centers of excellence that represent absolute world-class technology, leadership, and clinical capability in all those areas. But you know what? Most of our veterans suffer from the same things the rest of the population does. Diabetes, right? Some have, you know, they're overweight. They have congestive heart failure, cancers. Now, some of those are combat related if it's Agent Orange, but a lot of it is just normal population. And there's an organization, Jim, right here in Pennsylvania called Warrior Centric Care. And what they're doing is training hospitals and care providers in the unique aspects of treating veterans for common diseases. Okay. So I believe in the long term, we need the Veterans Administration health system to focus on centers of excellence that only they can do. And let's invite in some of the best provider systems in the world right here in Pennsylvania. UPenn, UPMC, AHN, Geisinger. These are world-class systems. The children's hospitals, I know the veterans probably wouldn't use that. And let's invite them in to help serve our veterans for those things that are not combat related, that don't require those centers of excellence. I think it's that hybrid, Jim, that we're eventually have to get to. And here's the good news. I've already been down. I know a number of folks at the Veterans Administration. There's some former McKinsey colleagues who are there, and I've talked to them, and they are eager to conduct pilots that extend the VA Choice program to more and more services. We want to be first in line for those pilots, and we'll be eager to work with them to help our veterans get the access they deserve to the best clinical care in the world.
And I appreciate hearing that. I've always been a big fan of getting the private sector involved to a large degree, because let's face it, the private sector does many, many things much better than the federal government does. But to your point, obviously the VA has access to certain information in a system that the private sector doesn't. So yeah, for them to focus on it, I think is key.
Yes.
We're about out of time, but I did want to get your take on the ongoing, especially here in PA, West Virginia, Ohio, right? The tri-state area, it's prolific here. And I know, you know, there's a lot of trafficking going on just from our little area that spreads out nationwide, as well as, obviously, as you mentioned before, the deaths every day due to opioid abuse. How do we get our hands around this? How do we, and again, putting aside, you know, a lot of the political labels and issues going on, how do we get our arms around this thing?
I I've spent a good part of the last 15 months, Jim, talking to people about this issue, because I cannot go into any community without hearing about it. It is the worst public health crisis in the history of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So here's how I think we should do it. It can't be solved out of Harrisburg. There's not a one-size-fits-all solution that addresses this. I listened to an expert at University of Pittsburgh, and she described the opioid epidemic in Pennsylvania as 18 different epidemics. Who it affects, the age groups, the agents, where the agents come from, very, very different depending on what part of the Commonwealth you're in. So that leads me to believe, when I combine that with the conversations I've had out in the communities, is that if we properly organize those relevant persons in each local community, so who are the relevant persons? The coroner, the EMS specialist, law enforcement, pharmacists. You could talk to any pharmacist at any pharmacy, and they could in 10 minutes tell you which doctors are over-prescribing painkillers in 10 minutes, right? They have the knowledge. You put these people together, physicians, pharmacists, EMS, law enforcement, coroners, the district attorney, okay? And you have the combination of, and maybe some not-for-profit groups, you have the combination of the clinical, the criminal, and the social issues that are contributing in that local community to this challenge. And you structure them in a way where they can get a fact base that they fully understand, and they share their perspectives with each other. And then I guarantee you, they know where it's coming from, which houses they're going to administer Narcan 12 times in 2 weeks, you know, that type of thing. And we can solve this problem. And then the state's role is to give them the resources to solve the problem. The state's role should not be to impose a one-size-fits-all mandate, which doesn't come close to solving the problem in that local community. So I have a inherent faith in the knowledge of the people closest to where this problem is occurring. They just need to be organized and structured in a way, and then resourced in a way where they can solve the problem. That's what I would do. And then when we found solutions in downtown Pittsburgh or in Wilkes-Barre or in Erie or whatever, let's bring those groups together and have them share that knowledge, because it may be relevant in a different part of the Commonwealth. So that's what I would do instead of trying to issue one-size-fits-all mandates from Harrisburg.
Makes sense. No, and thank you for that take on it. I'm always interested to hear people's opinions, because some people think it's a money issue, some think it's education, and it's all over the map. But I do know that we need to we need to fix it. It's not going anywhere. So what's your? I'll give you about 20 seconds here for a good closing message, Paul.
Yeah. Well, our campaign is very simple, Jim. It's about what I call restoring the dream of America to the people of Pennsylvania. It's time to bring our jobs and our children back home. If you're a 35 or 40-year-old in Pennsylvania today, born and raised here, you only know about factories closing, companies leaving, jobs leaving, population leaving, fewer congressmen. It is time we inspire Pennsylvanians. Turn this thing around. We have everything within our grasp to be wonderfully prosperous. We just need a new leader.
And with that, we're going to close out. And Paul, thank you so much for being on the show. I know it means a lot. It means a lot to me, but it means a lot to the veteran community to hear from you directly.
terrific, Jim. I really appreciate it. It's been a real honor to be on the show. And let me know. I'll be happy to come on anytime and talk to our great veterans.
Well, I appreciate that, Paul, and I might just have you back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right.
Have a good evening.
You too. And that was gubernatorial candidate Paul Mango. We are going to take a quick break and come back with some news right after this. If you want to keep up with the latest in veteran news away from the radio, stop by our website at www.theveteransreport.com. There you'll find news headlines, along with links to media outlets around the world. You can also find links to every state's veteran services office. And for you film buffs, there's even a link to a war movie database. We appreciate you stopping by the Facebook page at facebook.com/theveteransreport. There, like the website, you'll find the latest news and information related to veterans. For you high-speed individuals who want to limit yourself to 140 characters, stop by our Twitter account. It's a great way to find information on veteran organizations throughout the country and what they're up to. You can tweet us by using @TheVetsReport. If you'd like to email the show directly, please send us your input, comments, or suggestions to editor@TheVeteransReport.com. Thanks again for checking out our pages. Thanks for listening, and thank you for supporting our veterans community. And we are back on the Veterans Report. Again, we thank Mr. Paul Mango for taking time out of his day to speak with us and share his opinions and his insight. It's always good to hear from folks who are running for office. It's an interesting dynamic. You get a real glimpse into people's personalities when you just have a conversation, right? It's not scripted. It's not a debate. It's just a one-on-one kind of thing, and it's refreshing. So, and that's people of all stripes, right? We like to delve into what makes people tick. So again, thank you, Mr. Mango. So because we worked backwards, I am going to, what am I doing here? I'm covering, so the poll question. I want to get to this first because we always run out of time and I never feel like I adequately cover the poll questions. The poll questions are on the Facebook page, the Veterans Report Facebook page, and they're an important way for us to gauge where everybody is and whether or not we're covering the right information. And it's just fun, too. So last week, the poll question was, there are over 40,000 registered nonprofits or charities in the U.S. related to veterans and their families. And those are just the registered ones, right? The ones they know of, not the non-registered, scammy, sort of I'm doing this in my basement groups either. So large states like California and New York each have several thousand apiece. So the poll question was, do you feel that number of organizations is warranted, or is that too many? 33% said, hey, it's fine. We're good with 40,000 nonprofits and charities. Roughly 66% said, nope, way, way, way too many. I'm kind of leaning toward the way too many. I get it. I mean, but how many? Well, I don't want to pick on any groups, but I mean, there are a lot of groups that are doing kind of the same stuff everywhere. And I know some of them are local, right? I got to keep that in mind. I guess when I was looking over the data on this, I didn't keep that in the forefront, that some of these are just local iterations of the same thing. So maybe that question wasn't fair. So this week's question has to do with what just happened in Syria. So President Trump authorized a cruise missile attack on Syria in response to the Assad regime and Syrian Arab Army's alleged use of chemical weapons in the town of Douma. And Assad was then warned by the U.S. that any additional use of chemical weapons would result in another more severe attack. During his remarks, Trump said the missile strikes were limited and designed to send a message, but that ultimately the quest for peace in the Middle East is in the hands of the people who live there. And yeah, guess what? I wrote that. Those are my words. In your opinion, should the U.S. continue its involvement in Syria? Now, I know that's a broad question, right? There's a lot that goes into it. This is not a this is not a very easy, I guess, notion or situation to approach. There's a lot involved with this. We have troops on the ground. Our allies have troops on the ground. There are bad guys. There are more bad guys. There are other bad guys that we're kind of allied with. There are bad guys we're not allied with. And it's the situation is a mess. Okay. But the question, again, for the poll is, should the U.S. continue its involvement in Syria? Yes, we're obligated. Or no, let's get out. And again, keeping in mind, I understand that there's a ton of stuff that goes behind either one of those sides of the fence. But there's really, you could do a 5,000 word survey, and I don't want to get into that. You got to keep it simple. So jump on Facebook, the Veterans Report Facebook, take the poll, let us know what you think. You can also comment. So, and every now and then people chime in with that kind of criticism, like, well, this is not an easy question. So, Syria. So, as stated, the U.S. dropped a bunch of cruise missiles in Syria the other night. Interesting take on it, and I'll get into some news here. Well, now let me get into the news first. So immediately following that, right, the UN got together. Let me point out at the forefront what's really important, and somebody covered this on one of the 87 political roundtables that occurred. One of the most important aspects of this whole thing was not even the strategic value of the targets. It wasn't even sending a message from the U.S. to Syria or the U.S. to Russia. The real important aspect, well, I shouldn't say the, one of the most important aspects was the world seeing the United States, France, and Great Britain all working in unison, right? Common goal, common purpose, shared responsibility, shared decision-making. That's important. And as somebody said last night, I forget who it was. I think it was Colonel McGregor. I don't remember. Maybe it was one of the other pundits. He said it's important for the world to see them getting the band back together. And I agree. I mean, that's meaningful, right? Symbolically and strategically, but it means something. You have three of arguably the most, the strongest nations in the world. Three of the strongest countries in the world in terms of military experience, military training, military capability. And, you know, we have a history with those two countries. It goes back a long time. And so, yeah, it's good to get the three amigos out there in the front of the stage. So immediately following the strike, right, they had Mattis was out there. It was Secretary Mattis and General Dunford. And they were walking through a lot of the sort of the Q&A in terms of what happened, why did we do it, who was involved, etc. I got to tell you, it was kind of a weird press conference. If you didn't watch it, I suggest you go find the video. But a lot of sort of non-answers, which makes me kind of nervous, right? When they won't go into too much detail, and I get it. Part of it's OPSEC, right? Part of it's intel. Not showing their hand really on all fronts, but the fact that they didn't really, people were asking, hey, what evidence do you have to justify the strike? And basically the answer was, trust us, we got it. I'm not a big fan of that approach. I mean, we've seen that movie before, right? And then there was a follow-up press conference in the morning where it was, oh, I don't remember, was it McKenzie? I think it was General McKenzie and another spokeswoman, basically gave the same answers when somebody asked, well, what intel do you have? What proof do you have that Assad did this? The answer was, well, we have intelligence. Okay. That was it. And then they went to the next question. So I'm not a big fan of that. I'm not very enthused about this. If they had video or pictures of Assad in a helicopter kicking the bomb out the bay door, I'd say we should still be launching missiles. I mean, I'd be a big fan of leveling the country. But with no evidence, and I should say no visible evidence, right? They might have something behind the scenes to justify this, and I can't imagine they would go off sort of half-baked on something like this, especially Mattis. Mattis would be the guy to, I think, slam the door on any potential missteps in that part of the world. I really do. So if he said that there was intelligence that he saw, and he was singing a different tune earlier in the week, he was putting the brakes on this thing. So for him to suddenly turn around and say, hey, I've got intel that shows us, we're on the right path with going after, you know, pinning this on Assad, then I'm going to buy it. I'm going to buy it this one time. But moving forward, if they want to get more embroiled in that stuff, and that leads to the poll question, right? Should we stay involved over there? If they want to pursue this and they want to ratchet things up, they need to show things to the American people and explain why we're doing this. None of this trust us stuff. And again, I get the intel side of it, right? If there's actionable intelligence and it's verifiable and you have enough eyes on it and everybody says green, 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 yes, we got it, it's legit. Okay, I get it, but at some point you have to explain to the public what it is. Even if it's a watered-down version of, a couple of recon guys or some SF dudes out there taking pictures and notes, maybe they have, maybe they do have video of Assad being involved in this. Just something to think about. I don't trust politicians anyway, and B, again, and especially coming from Trump. Trump was the one a couple of years ago criticizing the Obama administration for being involved in Syria. And he was adamantly opposed, to increasing our presence there. He was opposed to it. And here we are launching missiles. So I just think, again, given a little bit of time, give it a couple of days, maybe dilute whatever intel they have, any evidence they have, and give it to us in a third grade level, but give us something. I can't support military action on a trust us basis, no matter who it is. I don't care who it is. So, but that happened. And then Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, was at she told the Security Council that the United States is, and this is a quote, locked and loaded, end quote, ready to launch another military strike if the Syrian government ever uses chemical weapons again. The emergency UN Security Council meeting had been called by Russia following the strike. Haley's counterpart, Vasily Nebenzia, said he would ask the Security Council to condemn the military strikes on Syria by the U.S., France, and Britain, calling the attacks a violation of international law and the U.N. Charter. France's U.N. ambassador gave what they called a biting response, telling Nebenzia that charter was not designed in order to protect criminals. So, getting into sort of a schoolyard fight there in the UN, but it's good stuff. Again, seeing the three amigos lined up, ready to square off, I think sends a resounding message to the rest of the world that we are back. Back for what? I don't know, but we're back. So, and there was another story. There was a story in the, pretty lengthy story in the New York Times. Apparently, and I missed this, Donald Trump tweeted out, relative to the strikes, mission accomplished, which of course brings back the image of George W. Bush standing on the carrier with mission accomplished behind him in 2003. Now, misunderstood or not, that didn't do him any favors later on, because most certainly the entire mission was not accomplished, and that's what Trump tweeted out last night. So the New York Times story is asking, that's cool, mission accomplished. What is the mission in Syria? And I think that's a fair question, right? Why are we there? Why are our troops there? Our troops right now, we have 2,000 American troops on the ground training rebels. Look, if we're gonna go down the Iraq path again or the Afghanistan path where we go in and we knock over a government, that take out the morality side of things. He is keeping the trains running, right? He's keeping the lights on. Now, again, the morality aspect to this is completely separate. I'm looking just purely from a black and white logistics perspective. Right? It's the same thing in Iraq. Yeah. Was Hussein a nut job? Yeah. Was he a murderer? Yeah. War criminal? Mm-hmm. Yep. But the government that was in place there, A, didn't affect Americans on a daily basis, and B, it was working at the time. Again, not ideally, but it was working. Same thing with Assad, right? The guy's a nutcase. Well, I won't even say that. He's not. I think he's a sane guy. Probably prone to some really bad decision making, but he's keeping his government running. And that's what begs the question, why would he, I'm going to go off on a tangent here and put on my tinfoil, why would he use poison gas in a conflict he was winning? Something like that, something that severe, is usually the mark of someone who is desperate. Right? That's almost like an ace. Right? You throw the ace down on the table. Why would he do that? That's my conspiracy side. But back to my point, if we're going to go in and topple a government that is actually working, then let's just go do it. Like, why play around with training rebels? Why go in as quote-unquote advisors? Why don't we just go in and take them out? And if we're going to do that, we need to rally about 200,000 troops, right? Go in, again, total shock and awe, with a plan, topple the government, have something ready to put in its place, and then be ready to leave within 180 days. Boom, you're gone. Boom, here's the new government. Bye-bye, we're out. But instead, we're going to drag on and drag on and drag on, and our guys are going to get killed. There will be Americans killed in Syria for no appreciable reason. And then, and a couple of weeks from now, somebody will hit us, and then a couple weeks after that, we'll hit them. And here we go again, right? Here we go again. There needs to be a plan. And look, I'm a big hawk when we're in the right. If we have a justifiable reason for going somewhere, let's do it. Let's go in and just bulldoze them. But, man, this is looking more and more like... This isn't even looking as organized as Iraq was. This is looking darker to me. Again, no explanation on why we hit them, what the intel said. I don't know. Just something for everybody to consider. So if you do talk to your legislators on a regular basis, maybe start asking them some questions. So I did want to tee up locally. I just got to take a minute locally. The Veterans Leadership Program, I don't think I have the stuff in front of me. Veterans Leadership Program of Western PA is, I probably shouldn't have teed this up then. It's in the summer. Hold on a second. I might have it in front of me. They're having a fundraiser, right? And part of it, I'll just tell you what my personal side is. It is a 3-day, 70-mile hike, and they call it the Crucible. I'm not a spring chicken anymore, so I'm going to have to train up for this one and probably get some new shoes. But they are, there's a small entry fee. I think it was $25. Again, 3 days, 70 miles, and it benefits the VLP. So if you're interested, jump on their webpage. They have the details. They're probably more prepared than I am. And it sounds like a lot of fun. They have some smaller events, and they also have, you can just donate money. Like if you don't want to go out and kill your knees like I'm going to do and be laid up for a couple weeks, you can just donate to them. But in the immediate, so they have something sooner. Oh, that's in September. I'm sorry. The Crucible hike is in September. On May 23rd, 2018, Veterans Leadership Program of Western PA is having their annual tribute. And that's a really, it's It's a tribute to veterans, and it's held, well, this year it's going to be at the Sheraton Pittsburgh Hotel in Station Square. And basically, it's a night to honor vets and service members and people who have done stuff like organizations, nonprofits. It's a really nice, I went to it a couple years ago. It's a really nice event. I don't remember if it's black tie, but it's you got to get dressed up. So no jeans. And tickets are $75 a piece. So again, that's for our local folks. I just wanted you to be aware of that. Jump on their website. And, oh, so there was a story ongoing, this ongoing drama of Hector Barajas Varela. He was a veteran. I think he was, did he serve in Afghanistan? I don't remember. Oh, he enlisted in the Army in 1995. Oh, no, he didn't serve in Afghanistan. Was discharged in, honorably discharged in 2001. And got into, you know, troubles with drugs. And then he had to plead no contest to a shooting. Oh, shooting at an occupied vehicle. Now, here's the catch. He was born in Mexico. And because of the shooting, he got deported. And he started a an organization down there, the Deported Veterans Support House of Tijuana, known as The Bunker. And that's where all these guys would go once they got deported. And he'd work with them on trying to get back into the States. Well, the short end of it is he is now back in the U.S. He went through all the proper channels. Governor Jerry Brown of California gave him a full pardon for his crime. And they invited him back to the U.S. Now, he's going to continue traveling back and forth between Mexico and the U.S. to help other vets who have been deported. So that's a good story of second chances and redemption and doing the right thing. So good for him. And that's going to do it, I guess, for this show. Yes. So yeah, if you have a chance, jump on the website, theveteransreport.com, jump on the Facebook page, or go to the Twitter account. We always try to keep it fresh and current. And that does it. Until next time, I'm your host, Jim Cannon.
You've been listening to The Veterans Report. Let others know about the show. You can find us online at theveteransreport.com. If you'd like to contact us, send an email to editor@theveteransreport.com. Join us again at the same time for up-to-date veterans news and information. The Veterans Report. Thank you for your service, and carry on.
The Veterans Report has been sponsored by James Cannon.